Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Speaking of lovely to have you here with us, Therese Davey is on the line. How are you doing there, Therese?
And they're lovely.
Aren't they? They're great. Really good.
So positive, literally, to keep you buoyed up and going. They're lovely.
You know the way you'd be. You know the way you'd be on a Monday morning. And then you'd be sitting there going, is there anybody out there? And then next thing, these lovely texts arrive in. So listen, Therese, we're going to kick off with the discoverireland.ie URL. Tell us what's going on.
I love this website because, and I come back to two or three times a year, because it's great for telling you what's happening around the country right now or in your county. And there's a great map that you click on and you click on the spot and see what's going on in that area. So, for instance, they're all about food and Taste of Ireland this month. Harvest Festival in Waterford, West Cork Food Festival are two examples.
Brilliant.
And it's a great chance. I mean, you know what these local markets are like, don't
Fab.
You? I mean, you
a
support
big fan.
Them.
Yeah. Yeah, big fan. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the funny thing is, Therese, like, you know, you can arrive in and find somebody that's either making food or something that you've never encountered before in your life, or there's something, some crafty thing, like somebody's made something out of a, you know, a piece of wood, and you're going, wow, that's extraordinary.
And they're reasonable, and they're someone you know, and you're supporting local industry. And some of the crafts, they never charge enough for the amount of work to put
That's
into
right.
them. And it's just lovely. It's
Absolutely.
Lovely to pay the person who made something. I see there's a Greenway grazing the Waterford Way. Now, that sounds very agricultural.
Sure does.
But it's we bring the food and drink that's sourced in the area to the trail itself, which is a lovely idea too. So discoverireland.ie to find out what the Taste of Ireland festivals are going on in your area. Support your local producers. They're trying hard.
And you know what? I mean, I've been back and forth to the Discover Ireland website, but I'd forgotten that they have the map with, you know, this is what's happening locally. And, you know, you'd never think, like, at least I wouldn't, you know, come a weekend and this is me, you know, I've got a 15-year-old and a almost 18-year-old, and every so often we'll be together, they're off and off doing their own thing. But a lot of the time you're there going, I wonder what I'll do today. It wouldn't even occur to me to just go on the phone and have a look at discoverireland.ie and see what's going on locally. And there's a great idea.
Absolutely. So that's the website of the week. What's out there?
Both. Yeah. So yeah, you're having a look at the kind of what's happening. And this is Lidl, am I right?
Yeah, Lidl and Aldi
deals.
Have them, and Deals have a lovely little miniature packet for £1.50. It's so, the time to start planting your bulbs.
Exactly. So explain to me, bulbs for what exactly?
The garden.
Yeah.
Irish-grown daffodils, Irish-grown
tulips, yeah.
Miniature ones you can pop around the herb pot I've made you all grow on your balconies.
Absolutely.
It's lovely. Isn't it lovely, Ronan, to go out in April or March and you open the curtains
and there's the flowers.
Lovely yellow.
You know what? You're absolutely dead right, because, you know, after a hard, dark winter, there's nothing better. So what you're saying is September, and if you plant now, it comes up around March, is it?
Some of them can start coming up as early as February, or you can extend bulbs all the way to May. There are late flowering bulbs as well. Check your packets, check the little pictures at the back. But the secret of bulbs is you throw them on the ground and you scatter them and plant where they've landed.
Oh.
To form a line.
Oh, very good.
Formal rows.
Yeah.
You throw them on the ground and plant where they are.
Yeah, and it gives that kind of natural look as they come up. Now, you've got a couple of other bargains that you can see there.
In Tesco at the moment, the large jars in Nescafe Gold, I'm stockpiling for the office.
Yeah.
Two for a tenner, which is a really good price.
Amazing.
Or three sips for a fiver, which are really, really
Brilliant.
Good price, which gets me on to my
job of the week.
Getting Brexit ready. Now, I know everyone is sick and tired of the word Brexit. I know they are.
My head is exploding. Go on.
Go to your cupboard or your press and see what food or supplies come from England, and you'll be really, really surprised at the amount of stuff. We don't make toilet roll or kitchen paper
or
sugar in this country anymore.
That's right. Of course, we don't do sugar. And what I found out very recently was we don't even provide our own flour. It comes from Scotland mostly. I didn't know that.
That's the big producers, like the bakeries. We do make some of our own for our own wee bit of bacon at home.
Okay.
We operate a just-in-time supply chain in this country, which means the food, it'll come in as it is needed. It's not stored in big warehouses or things anymore. Our products aren't stored. So if you're making a car at the back of Spirit there, you know you need your windows on Wednesdays and
you
need them on Friday. So that's how we operate. And I'm just asking people to look at the back or look in their cupboards and see what do they do in October or November? Are they baking for Christmas or something?
Very good.
I make apple jelly and chutney. Loads of it. So
lovely.
I need the jam jar covers and the sugar because they're both made in England.
Yeah.
So I stocked up in Enniskillen recently where the sugar was 57p, half price anyway.
Brilliant.
So I was thinking like that.
Very good.
I'm not doing a prophet of doom, Roman.
No. This is just being practical and pragmatic. You're absolutely dead right. And can I just ask you, are you kind of going on the basis that stuff from the UK could be problematic, but stuff from the EU or the rest of the EU will be all right because we might be able to get it in through France and kind of Rosslare and stuff? Or do you think that might be an issue as well?
It may be, there may be delays. That's the issue.
Yeah.
It's a land bridge. England is also a land bridge.
Of course it is,
just
yeah.
a supplier
yeah.
for our Worcester sauce and our mustard and the small things.
Yeah.
And maybe you don't want to run out of the one thing that you need in October, November, December and go mad because you can't find it in the shop. Because there may be just a delay. They mightn't have thrashed out the whole kind of customs and things like that.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying maybe buy the non-perishables and have one now and then.
You know what? That is an absolutely brilliant idea, Trace. Now, rubber bands. Talk to me.
Rubber bands.
Yeah.
I promise you won't start laughing. By
Go on, I do my best. I would always try.
No, promise. No, seriously. loads of uses. I was amazed at this site. Loads of different uses for rubber bands. Wrap it around the door handle to catch the lock. If you're making trips in and out outside the door. Did you see the picture there? It's
yeah.
clever.
Yeah, very good. I like it.
Yeah.
That's really good. So,
the door stays open.
So it means that when you actually, if you put the rubber band, like, so effectively what we've got done, right, is we've got the rubber band around both handles and it's catching right across where the kind of the snib, the lock goes in. So you just, it just keeps it open as though it's on the snib and it's just open. And it means that if you're whacking through back and forth and your hands are full, you're grand.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Open house, here's the solution. Use it as an impromptu wrist strap for cameras or gadgets or toys
so
they can hang on to them.
Yeah,
that was clever.
Yeah.
Sealing around bags, just it's lengthways on the bag so the things don't spill over. That was a very clever one.
Do you know what? That is really, really good. We were great in our, like my mum was a great woman for in our days of putting clothes pegs on things just to close those plastic bags to kind of keep some sort of a seal. But actually, I'm looking at your elastic band there, and actually if you go literally, as you say, lengthways, so you've got your plastic bag, you kind of roll it around at the top to create some sort of a seal, and then you go lengthways on the elastic band, and it would lock it off pretty well, actually, I think.
Very clever. And the next picture underneath, pumps. If you have pumps, if you hand pumps or soap pumps or washing up liquid pumps or something that you need to press up and down, the elastic band around the pump section will stop the children from getting at it because you've made the disconnect.
Yeah, very, very good. So just, you know, normal soap dispenser, just so I explained this, it's really clever. So what you do is you actually put it around, like underneath, between kind of the, what would you call the nozzle you part, which is the thing that goes up and down, and the kind of, I suppose, the original cover, or not cover, the lid of the soap, and in that little tiny space you can actually reduce that, so it means that the kids aren't taking masses of soap for themselves. They just take a kind of a half of an expectoration of soap. It's just
absolutely, or you can lock it off completely, like the day you bought it when that little plastic clip was on it.
Very
clever.
Yeah, excellent.
Wrap it around the top of a wooden spoon, there's another one, so the wooden spoon doesn't slip into the pot.
Oh, that's really good, actually. Yeah, that's a really good one. Didn't even think of that. That's very good.
Old one. Wrap it around the book that you're putting into your handbag so it doesn't open or flitter or the cover doesn't fall off. Really, really clever. Are those jeans, did those jeans ever get tight on your own? You know, that's
are you joking me? They've been tight for so long that I can't hardly remember. I can't hardly feel my legs now at this stage.
That's not healthy. That's not good.
No,
but you could wrap the elastic band, maybe that one day you're stuck and you really need to wear those trousers out.
Yeah.
Wrap the elastic band around your button, through the buttonhole and back out of the button, and you get a wee bit of a stretch on your jeans.
Oh, that's very good. I'm definitely using that one. That's definitely
a very,
very simple one.
Good. And I love this idea of putting the elastic band around the chopping board. Did you see that picture?
I did. This is really clever now, because actually, I don't know whether you're like me, but actually I find that particularly the larger chopping board, it's very hard to control things. Do you know? And actually what this does is it actually kind of, if you like, it stops things from flowing off one end. And that means that you could actually kind of use it to kind of funnel stuff in, particularly if you're chopping stuff into a bowl or something. You could use it to kind of, you know, just put it around the chopping board, anywhere in particular on the chopping board. And it allows you to kind of, like, say you're chopping carrots or you're chopping something like cucumber. And it just, you know, you're just going to be, just kind of whisk it off with your knife and your grand. Very good.
And more importantly, it stops the chopping board from moving around.
Oh, yeah, underneath.
Or a tea towel underneath it. The elastic band creates a friction so the chopping board isn't sliding.
I tell you, I have lost more fingers now chopping like that. And that's that'll really help me now, I'll tell you.
I've lost things off the top of the counter with the chopping board flying. Have you ever done that
one?
Right.
Oh, yeah. That's
a good one. Yeah. And the final one that's really good, did you see it around the top of the jam jar there?
Yes, very good,
Using it as a gripper to grip a tight jam jar or a tight container gives you that little extra grip if you can't open it.
That's right. If you're having a difficulty opening something and you just put it around the top of the jam jar, that's brilliant, actually. You never, ever tried doing that before. That's very good.
And finally, my last one, really last one, is homemade. It's time to get clean and behind the radiators and behind pictures and things.
Very good.
Get a ruler. Get that odd sock that you won't dump. You know the one you like? Have you one of those?
Yeah, of course, absolutely. I've about 12 of them. And it's just, they're lovely. Like, you know, I'm a bit of a hoarder, but it's just, you know, I get very attached to them, even though I can't wear them because they're odd. But anyway, come on anyway, sorry.
Okay, odd socks, Ronan Day.
Yes.
And then put the odd sock on the ruler and put the elastic band around it and use that for cleaning behind your radio.
Ah, very good. Yeah,
excellent.
So final message for students.
Message for students. This is the most important. All the people going to college this summer, this is the best summer of your life. It's the one where you grow up. It's the one where you enjoy the freedom and get out there, find your song for this summer, enjoy your hometown, enjoy these last few weeks before you go to college and become an adult.
Very good.
And just remember it. It's just brilliant. I can remember the song from me 30 years ago.
Go on, tell us.
And everybody wants to rule the world. Oh, like a Christmas tree.
You're bringing me back.
Out the edges of my cheeks.
You're bringing
and
me
that's
back.
My song from going back to college. So students, enjoy this, the best summer of your life. Get out
absolutely.
There.
Absolutely. Man, as you were working as a waitress in a cocktail bar. I'm older than you though, Trace. Okay, God bless you. See you now. If you're a parent with young children in the household, you might be familiar with the hearing questions such as, Dad, can I have my pocket money now? Can I have some money to go to the shop? When your child runs out of money, believe me, you hear about it. So it's really important to teach our children about money and being responsible with their spending from an early age. On the line now to give us advice, we have money doctor John Lowe. You're very welcome to the show, John.
Thank you, Ronan. Good morning.
Yeah, great. First of all, John, what advice do you have for parents in introducing their children to money?
Well, you know, as soon as they can count, to be honest, you should be starting to, give them that whole learning experience. You know, you have like the abacus, the simplistic Fisher-Price play and learn activity toys.
Absolutely.
First blocks, all of those kind of things are really important. Even the piggy bank. I like to, you know, with my brand color of yellow, which matches the streak down my back, I like to have the piggy bank in yellow, of course, obviously.
Sure.
But actually, you mentioned there at the start about pocket money, and it's very interesting, Ronan, that there was a survey done, and they found that the three sections of pocket money, national school, secondary, and third level, 10, 20, 60.
Okay.
That's the average pocket money given to children in those categories.
Okay.
And ironically, my three children were in all three categories in 1 year.
That's some spread. That is some
year.
Spread. Wow.
Yeah, so I had a 10, 17, and 20-year-old.
Expensive week as well for you.
Expensive weeks, absolutely, yeah. But, you know, as soon as your child is they can count, you really should introduce them to money. The next thing is really you can communicate with them. You know, give them values concerning money. And you know, parents will influence their children. There's absolutely no doubt about it. You find somebody who's got a mean streak in them, they didn't, you know, the old saying, lick it off the stones.
Yeah.
They got it from somewhere. And generally, it's their parents who are their biggest teachers. They're bigger than any other influence in their life.
Absolutely. You kind of, I suppose what you do is you kind of almost pass the value down the hand. And if you're very flahoolic with money and you know, lash it around the place, your kids will see you doing something similar.
It's the same. It's a bit like, you know, hate to mention it, but an alcoholic father, if you're a daughter, you probably wind up marrying an alcoholic person. It's that kind of influence that happens.
It's the familiarity.
Life.
I totally take your point. And as you say, in the same way, if somebody's a little bit tight and maybe, you know, unhealthily tight with money and not, you know, saving is one thing, but kind of, mean, as you say, that too can get passed down as well. Can I just ask you as well, like, just so that we can give our kids, obviously, so what you're saying is model something that's healthy, model good kind of management.
Yes.
But in terms of what we might say to them, what are the kinds of things we could teach them from early?
Well, I mean, even going to the shop, Ronan, children are really, really observant. And they see you going in the shop, you're maybe two or three or four maybe, and you're in the trolley, and you're going around, and they see you're putting stuff into the trolley, and at the end you go to this place where there's a woman stuck at a what seems to be some kind of machine, and she's putting this stuff through, has a funny sound to it. And at the end of it, you're either given cash, credit card, or a check. Well, a check is gone now at this stage. And the ironic thing is, in 5 years' time, Ronan, there won't be any cash, credit card, or debit card. It'll either be on your phone, or it'll be in your wrist, some chip that'll be there. They'll know that you're missing a tin of beans in the fridge and some potatoes. So children are observant. When they see what is happening, you should be explaining to them, what you are doing. Really, really important, because then they're learning all the time. Those first 3 years, by the way, are probably the most important years of a child's life.
Yeah. And
as
you,
learning.
Yeah, because you're okay. As you say, they're literally inhaling your values about things.
Yeah.
So when you're shopping with your child, you go out to the shops or in the supermarkets, and would you do things like show them the price tags or explain what's going on, or what do you think?
I don't know about the price, showing the price tags. Yeah, when you heard the beep at the cashier desk.
Yeah.
Yes, then you could say, do you know what that is? This is where there's a barcode there. It's called a barcode, and it's actually an amount of money that I have to pay for this particular product, and I'm going to pay it when it's totaled all at the end of the shopping.
And can I just ask you as well, John, when you have a child of a particular age, and I'm thinking, even under 10, would you encourage them to kind of set small financial goals for themselves?
Oh, I tell you, absolutely. This is the heart of learning all about money and saving. Even if you're giving them that 10 euros, say, you're 10 years of age and you're getting 10 euros a week, I would encourage that child to save maybe 2 euros or 3 euros a week out of the 7, and say, that's going to be, you want to give mum and dad a present? No point in coming to dad for mum's present or mum for dad's present.
Yeah.
When you have the money yourself, you'll be able to buy your own present, no matter how small it is.
Yeah, it feels like so much more special when you give it yourself.
Oh, much more special, because then you've my daughter, actually, I have to say she's 23, but she's still on the parent money.
Absolutely.
So I'm giving her pocket money, but out of her pocket money, she, my birthday recently, she brought me to see The Bodyguard in the Boycott Theatre, which was actually brilliant.
Wow.
She got at the end of the kind of ticket sale, so she got the last few tickets, and the last few tickets were up in the gods. So, of course, when I went to the theater and we go into the lift, I'm a bit disappointed even having to get into the lift. Anyway, when we get up and to the fourth floor, and the door is open, and suddenly as I came outside, oxygen, I need oxygen.
My ears are
popping. My nose is starting to bleed. I said, Dad, I know I can't afford it. It was a fantastic night, I have to say. The very fact that she used her own pocket money to buy me that ticket.
That's
and
special.
A huge amount.
That's
me,
so special.
Say.
Yeah, absolutely. You were talking about, putting money aside. Would you go so far as helping them open a bank or post office account or credit union account?
I think that's the best thing you could possibly do. The age of reason, they say, is the age of 7. And so you're talking about, at that stage, if you haven't opened an account. I mean, even as a former building society manager, I remember when I would hear a client who they just had a baby, I would immediately open up an account with them, £5 then, and send them off a passbook with the child's name and their name on it.
That's lovely.
And that meant, by the way, that child, I have a lot of parents who keep, you know, kind of thanking me, because when First Active eventually you know, went public, it meant that all these children, when they were taken over by RBS and Ulster Bank, they got in a little bit of a windfall.
Oh yeah, of course,
£5,000.
Yeah, it's not extraordinary.
You know, they had to have, I think, £250 at the time in the account.
But
70 years of age is really the age of reason when you really should have your child have some kind of account where they're saving. They know what banks, building societies, post office, the new sleeping giant, they should have some kind of account.
You know, it's funny, I was thinking, we were talking earlier on about values and the rest, and as you'd well know, here in Spirit Radio, you'd imagine that we would have listeners who would say they'd want to be giving to charities, or they want to be tithing to their church, or they want to be, you know, that kind of stuff. They want to be generous with their money.
Rowan, because, you know, you when you go to church and the plate is passed around, you know, you're given, theoretically, you know, if you're, you know, adhering to the Bible and to what is in the Bible, I mean, they have these tithes, and theoretically 10% of your earnings are meant to go to you know, either the church or the charitable organizations. I don't think a lot of people can
manage
afford
that.
Actually, sadly.
Sure.
But that's the ideal. That is the ideal.
Sure. And in a way, we could kind of help our kids do a bit of that as well.
Yeah.
Teach them generosity. Yeah, absolutely. John, it's absolutely fascinating talking to you. It really is. And thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Not at all. Real pleasure.
Great.
Thank you.
God bless you. And that's John Low, Money Doctor, and independentfinancialadvice.ie is his website. Now, yesterday marked the 80th anniversary of the outbreak of World War II, when Germany invaded Poland, which led to Britain and France declaring war on Hitler's Nazi state in retaliation. To mark the 80th anniversary of the outbreak of World War II, Ancestry.ie has conducted new research that shows surprising insights by Irish people on how World War II shaped their family histories. On the line now to tell us more, we have Simon Pearce, spokesperson from Ancestry.ie. You are very welcome to the show, Simon. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So first of all, Simon, sometimes it's hard to believe that World War II was only 80 years ago. So there are many people in Ireland who have family members who remember the outbreak of the war.
That's right. That's right. I mean, the First World War, it was like such a long time ago, but the Second World War really is in living memory. Of course, it's known as the emergency in Ireland. And our research shows, really interestingly, that there are indeed a number of Irish people that want to learn more about their ancestors. And around 50% of those that we surveyed still have a living relative old enough to remember the outbreak war.
Absolutely. And indeed, my father was old enough too. I'm of an age, I was born in the 60s. So it was like, you know, I kept thinking to myself, wow, I used to feel like the Second World War was miles ago. And then I'm thinking it was only 20 years before I was born. So it was actually much shorter before I was born than whatever. So tell us a bit about what Ireland was like during World War II, as you call it, the emergency. How did it impact on us as a nation?
Well, I think the thing to remember is that the Second World War was a very different experience for Ireland during this period. Ireland was neutral, and they didn't have conscription like they had in the rest of the UK. But it still had an impact on the country. You had elements of rationing, you had shortages, and you even had blackouts and curfews, queued food. But most specifically, there was even bombing of Ireland. I don't know if you've come across that before.
Absolutely, yeah. There was. I mean, obviously, the part of Ireland that was in the UK, the Belfast, there were. But actually, there was bombings in the North Strand in Ireland, as in, you know, the Republic of Ireland, which isn't. And I think they must have thought they were over possibly Liverpool or something like that?
Yeah, that's quite right. Most specifically was the 31st of May 1941 on the North Strand in Dublin City. And some sources claim that 34 were killed and 90 injured and a series of houses destroyed. And yeah, it's quite possible that the German Air Force thought they were flying over perhaps the north of Ireland or even across Liverpool. But it must have been terrifying for the people involved and perhaps reading and hearing about what was kind of happening in the rest of the UK. And even though Ireland was neutral, that, you know, they weren't protected in some ways from this bombing. And
yeah, no, absolutely.
It really shows that we still perhaps have ancestors, maybe a father, a grandfather, a grandmother, a grand aunt and uncle who lived through this period. And my suggestion is just to speak to these people, hear about their stories and what they experience, and you never really know where that can lead to and what kind of research that can kind of spark off from there.
It's so important because, you know, oftentimes people have little bits of information and they don't think of it as being particularly important, but until you ask them and find stuff out, you're going, and while they're with you, while they're still here, while they're still alive, it's really vital, because when they're gone, you can't ask them those questions. Can I, speaking of asking questions, can I ask you, Simon, you know, you've done this survey. What types of questions were asked in the survey?
The whole thing was quite simple, really, but, you know, what kind of, do you have a relative that served during the war, or when were they born? And simple things like, do you want to know more? And it seems like quite a simple question, but perhaps wanting to know more is quite a tricky thing. You know, where do you go to learn more about your ancestors? Where do you go to find out this information? And, you know, as I mentioned, definitely speaking to your ancestors is a way of learning more, but also logging on to ancestry.ie and checking out the different records we have, just not just military, but civilian records as well, and starting your journey there, really.
Absolutely. So what did the results highlight for you?
What was really interesting for me was, one thing that stood out was there was a 19% of the people surveyed had an ancestor or a relative involved in Operation Pied Piper. And you quite rightly pointed out earlier that tomorrow marks the 80th anniversary of the start of war. But it also marks the start of Operation Pied Piper, which saw in the first 3 weeks of September over a million families and mothers, children evacuated from the city, the danger zone in the UK. And it was really interesting to note that around 19% of Irish people had an ancestor involved in that, most likely living in the UK, perhaps in London, in the big cities, and they would have been evacuated. And that's an area that you could also follow up or maybe ask an ancestor about on what they experienced.
Absolutely. So in a way, I've the idea that you can connect in with people, you know, who are still alive and have who have either memories or maybe memories that have been passed on from, you know, older relatives again. Is it, do any of the findings particularly surprise you? Did you find that Operation Pied Piper statistic a surprise?
I did to an extent, yeah, because, of course, with Ireland being neutral, you didn't see the same level of evacuation on the island. You did have some people from the UK that went over to Ireland.
Sure, sure.
It was interesting to me. It really highlighted once more that perhaps a number of Irish people did have family that were living in the UK at the time, and they themselves were evacuated. Perhaps it was a great strain and a great worry for them, know, being in neutral Ireland, but, you know, what was happening to my relatives? Perhaps they had a brother in the UK or a mother or a father, and it must have been, yeah, really tough for them, thinking, you know, what were they going through?
Absolutely. Do you find your job interesting, Simon? This whole area of you know, DNA and finding out about people's backgrounds?
Oh, absolutely. I love it. It's so interesting to help people learn more about where they came from. I think it's a hugely important part. It's something, learning about your ancestors, whether it's a grandfather, grandmother, or great-great-grandfather or grandmother, it helps you to learn more about yourself, where you came from, and you never know what you're going to discover when you start doing research and what avenues it's going to lead down. And
yeah,
as I mentioned before, just starting with a simple conversation with a family member can really spark that off.
And, you know, it's funny, there's always something quite emotional about this. I mean, I always think, like, when you're you know, watching the Who Do You Think You Are kind of programs or something like that, you watch people and they get very, very emotional about things. But actually, when you start to look into your own background, that can be quite an emotional experience too, can't it?
It really can. And these people, these ancestors, they're not just a name on a page or a name on a document. They're in many ways, they're what make you up, you know,
part of you.
They're exactly that part of you. And when you really start to look in depth in their life, and, you know, you see them in a census, you see them in a newspaper or a death or birth record, you really start to feel like you kind of understand them and get to know them a little bit better. And it can be incredibly emotional. And as I mentioned, just, you simply don't know what you're going to find until you start researching and what exciting discoveries you're going to make.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's great talking to you, Simon. Simon Pearce, spokesperson for Ancestry.ie. Thank you so much for talking to us this morning. And let me just say that anyone looking to learn more about their backstory and their family connections to World War II can explore a range of collections on www.ancestry.ie. You'll probably be very familiar with the high-profile trial where the much-loved journalist and TV presenter Jill Dando was murdered in 1999, 20 years ago, would you believe it, and a man called Barry George was convicted, imprisoned, and then later was acquitted after an appeal and a retrial for her murder. Barry George was imprisoned for 8 years before this acquittal, and during this time, his sister campaigned to demand truth and justice for her brother's release. In studio now to tell us more, we have Michelle Diskin-Bates, the sister of Barry George, who has written a memoir about this time in her life called Stand Against Justice. You are very welcome to the show, Michelle.
Thank you very much, Ronan.
Delighted to have you with us. First of all, Michelle, I remember this case well. Probably one of the biggest cases at that time. Can you take us back to the that time in your life? You must remember the moment you heard that Barry had been arrested.
Yes. I mean, obviously, in Ireland, we didn't know too much about Jill Dando, but you couldn't miss her on
Absolutely.
The news.
Yeah.
She was wonderful.
Yeah.
And it was a whole year after she'd been killed. And I heard, I was waiting for Gerry Ryan to come on. And I was listening into the news. And the newscaster said, they have somebody arrested for this murder. And my immediate thought was, wow, I'm so pleased. I'm sure it's been about a year. That poor family must have been going through hell.
Yeah.
And then she said a name. She said, Barry Balsara. Now, obviously, that's not Barry George.
Yeah.
But I knew that Barry used the name Balsara in his email address.
Wow.
It was Freddie Mercury's real name.
His birth name,
and so that was why he used it, because he was a great fan of Freddie Mercury.
Yeah. And did it click even then?
Well, what clicked was, how many Barry Balsaras are there?
Are there?
And I started to shake.
Oh, no.
And I was getting ready to go to a ladies' Bible study that morning. And I really didn't know what I was doing. And I waited for them to say more, and they didn't say more. And it was like, from that very moment, just hearing that name on the radio, my life changed utterly.
Yeah, from that point on, everything changed. Can you tell us a little bit about Barry himself? Because, you know, we now have some background on him, and that, you know, there was a feeling that maybe they went after somebody who was, you know, quite vulnerable in some ways.
Yes. Well, Barry, he's got epilepsy. So, I mean, these are disabilities he was born with. So he got epilepsy. He had, when he was little, ADHD, but he's not hyperactive anymore.
Mm.
He grew out of that part. He is autistic, he's got Asperger's syndrome, he's got a low IQ, and he's got a couple of personality disorders. They're not dangerous, they're just personality disorders.
Yeah.
They're the way he thinks now.
Yeah.
Of course, other people will only remember that he has two convictions, and those convictions are against women.
Yeah.
And nobody will ever get me to back him up on that, because it's not right.
Hmm.
But even at the time of Jill's death, they were 15 years old, and he had not repeated them.
Yeah.
You know, the problem with things, disabilities of this nature, is that you can work on impulsivity. And unfortunately, he did.
And if you have ADHD, that's the prime thing, isn't it?
It is.
Impulsivity is very high,
yeah. But, you know, we don't apologise for him for that.
No.
But he has apologised himself.
Sure. But, so, just fill us in. So, we have Barry, who is obviously, you know, has his vulnerabilities, and he has his, you know, his issues. And then you have you as a family trying to come to terms. What was the next thing that happened? You heard, did you get phone calls from Britain? What happened then subsequently?
Well, I suppose the thing is, first, I had to ring my mum.
Yeah.
And she tried not to tell me, because she thought it would all blow away. And she wouldn't have to tell me. But obviously, then, we realised that wasn't going to happen. And my next thing was to go to England. Meanwhile, Barry had chosen his own solicitor, because he'd used her for a bicycle accident that he'd had.
Oh, dear, yeah.
And, you know, often it's a good idea not to go with the solicitor that the police give to you. They're fine for your initial talk with the police, but if you can get your own, it works out far better. So it was the right move. And she was very good. She contacted me constantly and kept me updated. Usually legal teams don't do that, but I think they looked at Barry's vulnerabilities and realised he would need it. So the next 8 years, that was my life.
Wow.
Backwards and forwards with legal people and doctors, because they had to bring in a team of doctors for Barry. A lot of people will know the name Michael Mansfield.
Of course.
He was Barry's QC. And his first meeting with Barry, he came out and he said to the solicitor, "What was that?" And they said, "Oh, he's just awkward." And he said, "That's not awkward." He said, "That's a disability.
Oh.
We have to get a team of doctors in here to check this out." You know.
Yeah, so he spotted it immediately.
He spotted it.
And, you know, I'm thinking, you know, you must have gone, surely, you know, with this set of disabilities, with the fact that, you know, there's a feeling of a stitch-up about this, that surely when it gets to court, he won't be found guilty. I mean, did you feel that, or were you very nervous that he would be?
Michael Mansfield had advised us that, really, because there's no evidence, that the first court ought to throw it out.
Oh.
And my heart rose.
Oh.
And then he said, "But with the nature of this case, and with the person who's been killed..."
It's the feeling for Jill, right? Yeah.
Yeah. "They're not going to be brave enough to do it."
Right.
And they didn't.
Yeah.
And you see, these were all the little places where this could have been stopped.
Yeah.
And nobody stopped it. Even at trial, anybody reading my book will get the full evidence that was at the trial. And you look at that and you think, but that doesn't point to murder. How did he get convicted?
Yeah.
Because there was nothing. But he did. Everybody all along the way was afraid to go against because of Jill's high profile.
Yeah, and she was so greatly loved, I suppose. People wanted it to be a slam dunk, and the fact that they weren't presented with that, they kind of, well, maybe. In fact, I've, you know, sat in jury rooms myself where people literally said, "Well, you know, there's no smoke without fire, you know, and the police think that it is, so it must be." And it's like, wow, we're not here. We're here to test that idea, you know.
That's right.
So I'm just thinking, you know, you're a woman of faith, Michelle. This must have really tested, because I'm sure you prayed and prayed and prayed.
It must have tested
your faith enormously, did it?
Very, very much so. And obviously praying before he was convicted, and the shock when he was convicted. And then people around me saying, "Oh, well, you know, nothing you can do now." And then I thought, no, there isn't. There isn't anything I can do. But God can. I can't fight the whole British justice system. I'm a single person. But God can fight the whole justice system. So we took on Goliath.
And how did that begin? How did the taking on of Goliath start?
Very, very slowly. I suppose it started really with Jerry Ryan.
Wow.
Because we didn't really know where to go or what to do. And Jerry's... I don't know what you call them. They gather the information.
Oh, yeah, his researchers. Yeah, his research team, yeah.
Researcher was quite strong in suggesting that this might be a good idea.
Yeah.
And so I went up to Dublin and I met Jerry. And we started to do a 20-minute slot. Then they cancelled the next 20-minute slot.
Yeah.
Then we went through to the end of the programme.
That's Jerry. He's a very old friend of mine and I'm greatly missed, but that was exactly what he would do.
I have to say, I miss him too.
Absolutely hugely missed,
And he gave me great advice.
Yeah, because he was a legal guy himself.
Yeah, and he said, "Please promise me you will not make this your life's work."
Wow.
Because I've seen people who do that and they become shadows of themselves.
Wow.
And I said, "I'm so grateful, Jerry. I had already determined that I would not, and I will never be a shadow of myself, but I'm so grateful that you said it."
Yeah, absolutely. And so that interview led to what exactly?
Well, we still then had to launch everything in the UK.
Sure.
And we had the Miscarriage of Justice organisation, and most people will know Paddy Hill.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
And they were helping me all the way through.
So the Birmingham Six guys were, and the Guildford Four guys.
Absolutely, yes. So we put a submission into the Criminal Cases Review Commission, they were set up in the wake of the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four. So
it's funny you mention it, because, I mean, I was thinking when this happened, and, like, I had no idea you'd be coming into me or anything like that, but at the time I remember thinking exactly the same way as when I was a kid and the Guildford Four and the Birmingham Six, and I remember looking at them going, they couldn't possibly be innocent, could they? Almost that, in the same way I felt the same thing about Barry George. And you just went, wow, exactly that same feeling where you just think, how could they have got it so wrong? Yeah. But it's interesting that those guys were there in a support role to you then.
Very, very much so. Paddy set up Mojo.
Yeah.
And then they rescued Jerry from his self-destructive tendencies after prison.
Yeah, because he was really, taken really to the bottle bad. And yeah, really all the, yeah, bad. Yeah.
And then he came in and helped. But I have to say, Jerry had the biggest soft spot for Barry.
Right.
And when Jerry died, we went up to his funeral.
That was, yeah, I remember he died.
Not too long ago.
Yeah.
And immediately, Jerry's sister ran over to Barry, threw her arms around him and hugged him.
Yeah.
You know, we've had the most amazing things happen out of this, and they're not all bad.
No, absolutely. I do remember, actually, again, it probably was Michael Mansfield again, talking about the case, and, you know, he just was so cogent, and, you know, and suddenly went, oh no, this guy's been wrongly convicted, this is terrible. And tell me about that process of the second trial and the appeal and all the rest. What was that like for you? Did you feel like, oh, we're getting a little bit of traction now? Did you feel that the prayers were finally being answered, or were you still very nervous?
I was still very nervous. You really can't be it's not a good thing to start feeling confident.
Yeah.
Because you could be knocked down again. We'd won the appeal, and that was great. And they told Barry that the best thing that could happen is that they would request the retrial, because then they would test the rest of the evidence and it would be proven that there was no evidence. So we didn't contest it when they asked for a retrial. And I believe we could have done so. So he won the retrial. It was a unanimous verdict, and, you know, it again changed our lives.
But bizarrely, they wouldn't give him any compensation for the 8 years that he spent in prison. Why was that?
Yeah. Barry was the first person this happened to. There was a law brought in that unless you had proven your innocence beyond a reasonable doubt, you would not be given compensation. But in Barry's case, all the way through, he was told, you have nothing to prove, it's for the prosecution.
Exactly. Innocent until proven guilty, am I right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I honestly do believe there are many, many legal minds in Britain who are battling this, and I believe it's going to have to be overturned.
Well, there's got to be a High Court challenge in that. There has to be.
Yeah, it's unlawful.
So I did read a quote from you, which I thought was kind of brilliant, and explained it, the idea that he was innocent, but not quite innocent enough.
Yes.
Which is just, like, ridiculous, you
yes.
know?
I mean, we know that in Scotland, they have a not proven.
Yeah.
But Barry wasn't not proven. Barry was unanimous, not guilty verdict.
Yeah, exactly.
Very different thing.
Very, very different. So, obviously, that then creates another set of issues for you, because now you have a guy who is, he's free, he's out, but he's now probably traumatized by the entire experience, and he wasn't great to begin with. He was vulnerable to start with. So how do you manage somebody who's like that, and who probably gets a little bit, you know, fixated on wanting to prove that innocence?
Oh, well, Barry is still fixated, though that's not the right word. He is obsessed with it.
Yeah.
But every miscarriage of justice victim is the same.
Yeah.
Although, excuse me, although we look for compensation because it sort of says, okay, they're accepting that they were wrong. But what every victim wants is an apology.
Yeah.
We're really sorry, this happened to you and it shouldn't have.
Yeah. And we did it. Yeah.
They won't
give it to them. Yeah. And you know what? That is the heart of so much. I'm convinced that, you know, immediately we get rid of about 80% of our legal, particularly the kind of legal stuff that we do for civil reasons. We'd probably get rid of half. If somebody would just put a proper apology in place, and they haven't given that to him. And how does that make you feel as his sister?
Well, for me, I would like to see that happen, but I'd like to see that happen for everybody. But we have to deal with Barry on a daily basis. Mm. Barry had to leave the country of his birth. I had to rescue him from it.
Yeah.
I had to bring him to Cork.
Because the tabloids really came after him, didn't they? The Red Tops.
He was a cash cow.
Yeah.
If they used his name, they'd sell papers.
Yeah, his picture on the front page would sell papers, yeah.
And they didn't mind the fact that we could prove that he was lying.
Yeah.
That they were lying about him. We had all the proof.
Yeah.
We knew where he was and who he was with. And they still printed lies. It was like, we're untouchable. You can't do anything about this.
But he did go after them in the end, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And it's just as well he did, because they paid him.
Yeah.
And he now has his own apartment.
Right.
Because Barry otherwise could, at this stage, be living on the streets.
Sure.
You know, that's the type of vulnerabilities that he has.
Yeah. And, you know, I know that he's living here, so he had some respite, at least from the British, you know, tabloids and that kind of thing. But, you know, in all of this, you know, and you hear some of the alternative theories of what happened to Jill Dando, they're very, very dark. And, you know, by making all this, by the tabloids making all of this about him, they've actually missed out on maybe what could turn out to be a very, very serious story about the killing of Jill Dando in the first place, and we've heard nothing more about that.
No, I know all the way through, I used to think, where are these guys who did Watergate?
Yeah.
They exposed Watergate. Where are the guys like that?
Yeah.
But it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And it's really very sad, not just for us, but for Jill's family.
Of course, yeah.
You know, it's appalling. They've 20 years and they don't know who killed their loved one.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, Barry is free. Barry didn't do it. But, you know, they've kept him, the police have kept him in their front sights. Every time the case is brought up, you know, it's, oh, well, we'll look at new evidence if it comes up.
Yeah, they just don't want to admit they made a mistake.
No.
So they more or less keep him there as a kind of a placeholder, as it were.
Exactly.
I want to give you a chance to tell people where to put, but we've gone over, but it's such a good story. I wanted to make sure we could do that. Where can people purchase the book? It is called Stand Against Justice by Michelle Diskin Bates. Where can people get it?
Well, they can get that from christianbooks.ie.
Yeah, christianbooks.ie,
yes.
And we all know that. Very easy. Just go straight there on online and you can get it. It's called Stand Against Justice.
Against Injustice.
And what do you hope people will take away with them from reading this book?
I hope that some people will realise that their blind faith in the justice system can be a danger. Look at it. Read the book. See where you may have to protect yourself. Also, if you've got somebody living in your area and their loved one is in prison, they don't need for you to be mean to them. They need for you to love them and give them support. Whether that person in prison is guilty or not guilty, the family didn't do anything and they need your support.
Absolutely.
There are many, many reasons why I wrote the book, but they probably would be the biggest ones.
Yeah.
And exposing lies.
Absolutely. Well, it's a wonderful book and beautifully written, if I may say. And it is a really, really good read. You can get Stand Against Justice from christianbooks.ie. And I believe there was a song that we wanted to play.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's actually the song that I felt that non-Christians would understand why I am a Christian. And so it's In Christ Alone.
Okay, and this is the Passion version. Michelle Diskin Bates, thank you so much for joining us this morning. God bless you.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.